Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today, our show is titled Stateless But Not Lawless, The Myth of the Wild West. And with us today is our special guest, Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo. Welcome, Tom.
Pleased to be with you, Michael.
Glad you could make it. So, folks, Tom is an economics professor at Loyola University in Maryland and a senior scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute and the author of several excellent books, all of which I highly recommend, including How Capitalism Saved America, Hamilton's Curse, and The Real Lincoln. So, Tom, we're going to talk about the culture of violence in the American West, the myth versus the reality, even though most Americans think the Old West was lawless. There's scholarship that the American West was stateless, but, as you say, stateless but not lawless, and this scholarship has been building for some time, hasn't it?
Right. Some historians have written that the violence on the American frontier created a culture that lives on to this day and is responsible for a lot of the violence that we see in American society today. But the research that you alluded to shows that the wagon trains and the mining camps and the cattlemen in the American West, before there was a state presence out there, were actually very peaceful, and there was very little violence. There was not no violence. There's always human conflict, but there was very little of it because these people basically policed themselves.
Okay, so have most historians just assumed there was pervasive violence in the Old West?
Yeah, it's not a very good method of research. They assume that there was a lot of violence, and then they write books and academic journal articles attempting to explain why there was violence. But the basic premise or the assumption is false. It is much more peaceful than American cities are today, to be sure.
Yeah, they actually make the assumption that it was more violent than today.
Yes, that's dead wrong, though, as far as that goes. These were relatively peaceful societies. The wagon trains, for example, had constitutions, and if you didn't abide by the constitutions, you would be ostracized or kicked off. Mm-hmm. And the same was true with the mining camps. You had mm-hmm. to sign a contract to become a member of a mining camp during the gold rush, for example. Mm-hmm. And if you broke the laws or the rules, they would open your claim up to anyone. Anyone could jump your claim mm-hmm. if you broke the rules and did not behave. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty good self-enforcing mechanism. Mm-hmm. And so violence was not used to enforce this sort of, you know, good behavior. It was just, it was all voluntary, contractual behavior.
Mm-hmm. Other authors have tried to bring skepticism to this myth of the Old West. You mentioned Roger McGrath. He also mentioned that he wrote the frontier was not as violent for the most part, and that others have attempted to prove this or assume this violence, but they continue to just create and perpetuate this myth.
Article, and your listeners can get a hold of it online. It's by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill. It was written in the Journal of Libertarian Studies, which is online, in 1979. It was called The Not-So-Wild Wild West, mm-hmm. and they cite a lot of the literature that was even as of that time that showed that the Wild West was not so wild after all. Mm-hmm. So contrary to all those Clint Eastwood movies that you've seen.
That's very interesting. So this is something that you mentioned that there's a quote, I'm actually stealing from your material, that the Western frontier was far more civilized and more peaceful and a safer place than America's society today, and that the West is perceived as a great place, a place of great chaos with little respect for property and life. So I'm going to actually interrupt you from answering that or addressing that, because we're going to take a brief break. And folks, when we come back, we'll be continuing with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo. We'll be talking about the myths of the Wild West. So this is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. And please stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. Folks, this is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo, and we're talking about myths of the Old West. And, Tom, you mentioned that the West was not very violent, actually. Is that correct?
That's right. There's a lot of research now by academics that shows that the civil society in the so-called Wild West was not so wild at all, and it was relatively peaceful, certainly much more peaceful than American cities today. And the people there policed themselves long before there was any state presence.
And they had private agencies that they created themselves before actually there was any state available to monitor this. What were some of these private agencies?
There were what were called land clubs, cattlemen's associations, wagon trains were among the most prevalent. The land clubs, for example, were set up as a way of establishing property rights, and they had their own constitutions and rules for living in a civilized society. And a lot of times just social ostracism was used to get people to abide by the rules. There was no need for violence, and so there was conflict, but it was very, very minimal, and they were self-enforcing.
When were these land clubs actually set up?
Well, this was all throughout the middle of the 19th century and the late 19th century, mm-hmm. when the gold rush was 1848, and so when people started going out west, from the East Coast for that.
Was this before there was any government in place?
Yes, this was before there was any state governments, and when, of course, the central government, the federal government, was so small, it didn't have much of any presence at all. Even up at the time of the Civil War, when the Civil War broke out, there were just really a few Indian forts out west, uh-huh. Which was, in Missouri and places like that. Uh-huh. And so there was really no governmental presence at all. And these people essentially set up their own governments, just, sort of like how homeowners associations today set up their own rules and regulations for living in a civilized way with your neighbors. Americans have always done that.
Oh, very interesting. So they didn't need government. They didn't wait for government to help them. They just decided to do this for themselves.
No, there would have been chaos had they waited for government to help them, but... the wagon trains, for example, set up established constitutions, and you're required to sign off on and promise that you would abide by all the rules in the constitution of the wagon train. And they would ostracize you if you broke some of the rules, and if it was egregious enough, they would kick you off and make you leave the wagon train.
What were some of the rules that they had?
Well, just against theft and that sort of misbehavior. So
sure.
Any kind of criminal behavior of any kind.
So pretty minimal.
Pretty minimal. Yeah. They weren't central planners. They just wanted to have a civilized way of traveling. Mm-hmm. And it worked very well. That's how the wagon train succeeded in making it all the way out to California without anarchy.
Well, you mentioned that miners began forming contracts with one another to restrain their behavior long before government was there, but as you pointed out in the lecture I heard you give, dozens of movies have portrayed the 19th century mining camps in the Wild West, quote-unquote Wild West, mm-hmm. as hotbeds of anarchy and violence. But is this correct?
No, the mining camps set up contracts. You had to sign a contract to enter a mining camp and be a miner, and it would give you property rights and a certain amount of property where you could mine for gold or whatever you were mining for, and any gold that you would find would be yours. But if you misbehaved, if you stole somebody's gold, or if you mined on somebody else's property without their permission, the contract would be voided, and the other members of the mining camp would be allowed to jump your claim.
So this was enforced by the miners themselves?
It was enforced by the miners themselves. There were no sheriffs, there was no government. It was the miners themselves that enforced it. And the important thing is they enforced it without violence.
Mm-hmm.
There was no need to use violence, contrary to all those Western movies that you've seen. And so even the mining camps were relatively peaceful places.
Did the miners actually defend each other? From outside problems that they might have had?
Well, sure. It was if they had outsiders threatening some of the miners, they would be threatening all of them. And so just like any community would try to protect itself, just like today we have some communities that have volunteer neighborhood watch and that sort of thing. That's nothing unusual for people to police their own neighborhoods or to hire sort of private police to help protect them.
And they did that on occasion.
They did that on occasion, and cattlemen associations did something similar. They hired expert marksmen to police cattle rustling. And just the mere knowledge that they had hired expert marksmen, or gunslingers as they're called in the movies, to police the cattle rustling was a deterrent, of course, because it would make it much more costly and dangerous to be a cattle rustler. And every once in a while, some of these men would engage in criminal behavior, as you would expect,
sure.
Gunslingers. But it never did become any situation where there was sort of a criminal gang. By these expert marksmen out there, they just they were paid to be sort of like a private police force, just like your local shopping mall has.
Going back to the miners for a minute, did it help that the miners were basically all armed individually?
the people in the American West certainly were armed. And, of course, the knowledge that a mining camp was armed would be an excellent deterrent for many criminals who would think of committing criminal acts in the mining camp. It would be a very dangerous thing. So gun ownership certainly was a deterrent to violence in the mining camps.
I want to jump back to this point that you also just made about the Cattlemen's Association hiring these private snipers, basically, that some of them, of course, drifted off into a life of crime, but they never created large-scale criminal organizations, I think I heard you say.
Right.
And this concept of a regime of private law enforcement is actually pretty much on today considered an extremely radical kind of an idea.
Right.
Because I think the number one objection that people make to it is that, you're just basically empowering private mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that didn't happen at all.
No, it didn't. They had private law enforcement, if you will. And you're right. The people who oppose this and defend the state having a monopoly on the police power always make the argument that, well, what would stop these people from using their guns to be a big mafia? And, well, historically, they never have. And, we have plenty of private police now. There are more private police in America than there are government police. With all the security guards at all the malls and in neighborhoods and so forth, there are more privately employed police than there are government police. And, of course, they don't form mobs, do they, and criminal gangs. They could. A lot of them have license to carry.
Mm-hmm.
They could commit crimes if they're running around armed and you and I are not, but they don't. And they didn't in the 19th century either.
You know, this is really very interesting. We were talking after your presentation, a few of the folks and myself, about how we were basically, for lack of a better term, brainwashed by the television shows, the movies, and not just that, but we learned in school the West was this extremely chaotic place.
Well, that's the whole theme of government, isn't it? That the civil society, the free market, are dangerous. They will rape you. They will monopolize you. They will rip you off. They'll take your money, destabilize your life. Therefore, you need the state to protect you from all these things. And the more research I do on all these stories like this one, the Wild Wild West, the more obvious it is that this is all one big lie that the government and its court historians over the years have made up about the evils of the civil society. It has always been true that the peace and voluntarism and mutually advantageous exchange have thrived until the state intervenes and stops it from thriving. Once the state did show up in the American West, quite a few of the police departments and government law enforcement were very corrupt and very ineffective in controlling crime. And the civil society did a much better job in the early days of America in controlling crime compared to some of the government bureaucrats.
Well, folks, I would like you all to take special note of this, because in our upcoming shows, we're going to also be presenting this from different perspectives and other scholars that we hope to be interviewing on this particular point of how we don't really need government to provide peace and coherence and cooperation in society. Here we have a clear example of how private law enforcement actually worked. So you mentioned something earlier in the show here that the American West of the 19th century was much more peaceful than America's cities today. Could you expand on that a little bit?
The city that where I work in Baltimore, we usually have about 300 murders per year. It's just murders, one form of crime. And in the American frontier, of course, the population was much less than the cities of today. But that sort of thing was just extraordinarily rare in the areas where I've studied, the land clubs, the wagon trains, the cattlemen's associations. There was nothing at all remotely comparing what goes on in American cities today. And it's, largely caused by the government's war on drugs and its welfare state that has caused poverty among millions, which leads to all kind of trouble.
Well, we're going to come back after the break, folks, and we're going to expand this conversation with Tom DiLorenzo on the real violence in the American West. So stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. Michael McKay, your host. We'll be back right after the break. Stay with us. And we're back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am talking with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo, and we're talking about myths of the old American West. And we talked about, in the last half hour, how the American West was largely peaceful due to the peaceful cooperation of people that had the incentive to actually be peaceful and prosperous. And I want to mention also, folks, before we go much further into the show, that this particular show is being taped during the Property and Freedom Society conference in Bodrum, Turkey. And I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. DiLorenzo, as well as attending many lectures here by very many prominent scholars who are coming from around the world to actually outline how the world has actually survived, not only with a more minimal state, but without a state altogether. And so I would invite you to look at this website at propertyandfreedom.org, as well as, of course, Mises.org, and study the scholarship. As new as that may be to you, this is a worthwhile course of study on the, you could say, the science of peaceful cooperation, which is what we're really talking about today. But we're going to take a turn now in the other direction and talk about the real cause of violence in the American West. Weren't the settlers always at war with the Indians?
No, there's a lot of cooperation from the Indians. After all, the famous story of how John Smith married Pocahontas. Indians celebrated the first Thanksgiving with some of the settlers. And I lived in Tennessee for a while, in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and I lived where I could look out my front window and see a place called Ross's Landing on the Tennessee River, and it was named after John Ross, a white man who was the head of the Cherokee Nation in the 19th century. And so there was a lot of intermarriage between whites and Indians at that time among the Cherokees and blacks, American black, mm-hmm. black people. Mm-hmm. And so... there was a lot of trade. By the time you get into the 18th century or the 20th century, the English and other European immigrants had paid over $800 million to purchase Indian land.
That's amazing.
And the early Europeans and especially the English recognized property rights that the Indians possessed, and they paid them for
the land. American whites were not really just land grabbing. and battling the Indians for each inch of property. They were buying the property.
No, there was a lot of trade and commerce, as well as conflict. You know, human beings being what they are,
yes,
there was conflict from the very beginning.
Of course.
But trade tended to dominate. There was more trade than raid, if you will, for until at least about the Civil War era. And like I said, it's human nature, isn't it, to think, well, I have two options. I can prosper and make money by engaging in the fur trade with Indians, or we can go to war. You know, which is preferable? War is always more costly.
Right.
And trade is always preferable to war in a situation like that. And so they cooperated in the fur trade and other places for many, many generations. And so it's just not true that there was always antagonism between the Indians and the white settlers that came to America.
I recall that you quoted a scholar friend of yours, Ms. Jennifer Roback, that she wrote that the Europeans generally acknowledged that the Indians retained possessory rights to their land.
Right. They recognized the property rights that they had to their land. And of course, if you don't do that, then it's all fair game, and you feel justified in taking it from them rather than paying for it like civilized human beings would do. And like I said, by the time you get to the 20th century, there had been $800 million worth of such trades. And in those days, that was a lot of money.
Yeah, that's amazing. This is a lot different from what I grew up with. Believing based on TV movies.
I saw school. All the same cowboy movies you did.
Yeah, that's true. So, for the Indians, what were the incentives that they had for peace, and what incentives did they tip them toward war?
As I said, there was always some degree of conflict and some degree of trade and cooperation. And I think the conflict, though, really intensified and accelerated during and after the Civil War. And the main reason for it was that the U.S. government decided that the Indians had to be eradicated to make way for the government-subsidized Transcontinental Railroad. And in some of my writings, I contrast this with the fact that a man named James J. Hill built the Great Northern Railroad, which was a non-subsidized Transcontinental Railroad. That received no government grants and no land grants of any kind, and he paid the Indians for the rights of way through their property with livestock or money or whatever they could trade for, because he was not government subsidized. But the government subsidized railroads would just call in the army and have them kill everybody in their way, essentially. And that began really in earnest during the Civil War, and then once the war ended, it was greatly accelerated. It became the main project of the U.S. Army, the extermination of the Plains Indians.
Wow. So we're going to talk more about this in the next segment. We don't really have time to go into another question and answer before we take another break, but it's pretty obvious that the Indians hated the standing army concept, but they were more okay with the militia concept.
Right.
And
yeah, well, once the standing army was there, it made it very cheap for the railroad builders to get rid of the Indians. As long as we had militias, it was much more expensive. But the standing army was a way of socializing the cost of building the railroads.
Okay. So we're going to take another quick break, folks. Please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. We'll be back right after the break. Thank you very much for listening. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and your host, Michael McKay, and I'm speaking with Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo, and we're talking about the myths of the Old West, that it was stateless but not lawless. And we started talking just before the break about how violence really came on the scene primarily from government and not really from the Indians and settlers themselves, but that the Indians actually, even though there was some violence at all times on a marginal level, that the Indians really hated the standing army concept, but they seemed to be more okay that the U.S., early U.S. settlers formed militias.
The militias were there to try to defend citizens against Indian attacks or any other problem. But the standing army that showed up had the purpose of exterminating the Indians. Mm-hmm. Just 2 months after the end of the Civil War, after Robert E. Lee surrendered in April of 1865, and by July of 1865, General Sherman himself was put in charge of the military district of the Missouri, which is all land west of the Mississippi, and his job was to eradicate the Indians. And so for the first time, we had a large standing army in the West, barely two months after the end of the Civil War, with the purpose of waging a war of extermination against the Plains Indians.
This is very interesting on another level. I remember hearing you say this before, that it was 1865 April when the Civil War basically ended, but only a couple of months later, the U.S. is formed into military districts throughout
right.
the entire
right.
country.
Yeah.
In other words, the Union continued the war concept in terms of the management of the country.
Sure. Certainly the South was under military dictatorship for 10 years after the war, and then the same army, all the same generals, Grant, Sherman, Sheridan, Custer, moved ahead and went and started murdering Indians. They ended up killing about 45,000 of the Plains Indians, women and children included, according to one recent book, a scholarly book that's based mostly on government military records on there. And so,
what time frame was that over?
That was 1865 to 1890.
So about 25 years they
About 25 years. A year before he died in 1890, General Sherman wrote a letter to his son bemoaning the fact that his armies did not kill every last Indian in North America. And, of course, Sheridan and Sherman were known for the slogan, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian."
Amazing. So when did the Congress actually decide to stop the peace treaties with the Indians?
Well, in 1867, they actually passed a law saying there would be no more treaties. And so for all of American history up to that point, there was mostly trading with the Indians, although there was also some raiding or conflict or war with Indians. But as of that period, 1867, there would be no more peaceful relations with the Plains Indians. There might have been a few attempts here and there, but that pretty much says it all, doesn't it? That when Congress passed a law saying no more peace, essentially,
really,
and so that and they that's what they did. There was perpetual warfare against the Plains Indians. Even some of the Indians who wanted peace and wanted to live peacefully were not allowed to.
I want to go back also and talk a little bit more about these five military divisions that the U.S. government divided the country into. The purpose of, you say, of giving Sherman his command, which really commenced in the 25-year war against the Plain Indians, you make the point that it was a veiled subsidy to the government-subsidized railroad corporations.
Right.
How did these... Did this subsidy to the railroad corporations start after the Civil War or during the Civil War?
No, it started during the Civil War. A friend of Abraham Lincoln's named Grenville Dodge would become the chief engineer of the Transcontinental Railroads, but during the war he was appointed as a general, even though he had no military experience, by Lincoln. But his job was essentially to organize the killing of Indians who stood in the way on the beginnings of the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, which he was working on during the Civil War.
So that was like 1862?
1862. The Pacific Railway Act was passed by Congress and signed by Lincoln in 1862.
So this genocide of Indians really started during the Civil War?
Right, it started during the Civil War, and there was also, during the war, the famous Sand Creek Massacre in eastern Colorado, where a group of peaceful Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians had made peace with the U.S. government. And the U.S. government said, we promise to leave you alone. Just keep flying our flag. Any soldiers who come by will know that you're one of the peaceful tribes. But they lied. They invaded the village, the Cheyenne Arapaho village, and killed everybody there, hundreds of people, including women and children, and all the women and children included were scalped, And then they rode through downtown Denver, the Colonel Shivington and his troops waving the scalps in the air and posturing as conquering heroes.
Didn't the women in that tribe try to tell them, look, we're not warriors?
There's one account of this massacre. It was by a man named S.L.A. Marshall. He used his initials when he wrote his name, and he wrote a book called Crimsoned Prairie. And he was the official government military historian of the European theater of World War II. And he wrote 30 books on U.S. military history. So this is quite the expert on American military history. And he wrote about how during this particular battle, the Sand Creek Massacre, which wasn't really a battle, the squaws, the Indian women, came out of their teepees to identify themselves, to let the soldiers know that they were women. But it didn't matter. They were all killed and scalped anyway.
So, talking more about the going back and talking about the railroads and how this interplayed with the whole thing, you make the point that these railroad corporations were really the financial backbone of the Republican Party at that time, and that subsidizing the railroads was a primary, if not the primary, objective of the new Republican Party, which had just been
formed. Right. Sometimes I think that the only purpose of the Republican Party was to funnel subsidies to the railroad corporations, because as soon as the war started, the Civil War, in Lincoln called a special session of Congress in June of 1861, barely 2 months after the war had started, to get the ball rolling on the Pacific Railway Bill. And so here's a war being fought. Washington, D.C. itself is being threatened by the Confederate Army. And what's Lincoln's priority? It's building a railroad from Iowa to California. And so that tells you about his priorities. And, of course, he appointed Grenville Dodge to commence the killing of the Indians during the war. And then, of course, Lincoln was a general counsel, a counsel for the Illinois Central and many other railroads in the Midwest during his time as a lawyer. And they were the major financial backbone of the Republican Party. These are some of the biggest corporations in the world at the time, companies like the Illinois Central and the New York Central.
So you were many of the Republican members of Congress in on this?
Oh, yes. When they passed the Pacific Railway Bill, many Republican members of Congress said, I'll vote for the bill if this, for example, Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, said, I'll vote for the bill if you promise to use American-made steel to build the rails. And, of course, he was a steel manufacturer. And then Oakes Ames from Massachusetts said, I'll vote for the bill if you promise to use American-made shovels. He was a shovel manufacturer.
Oh, funny that.
And so there was a lot of the typical political deals that you see today that are totally and thoroughly corrupt. But that's the way politics is. And in one book that I cite by D. Brown, who was the preeminent historian of the American West, he pointed out that the Pacific Railway Bill created what he called dynasties in America by families who got contracts like this and became instantly extraordinarily wealthy, even though they did little or nothing to become wealthy but have political connections.
You mentioned that Sherman, General Sherman, was no friend to the American Indian. He referred to them as thieving, ragged Indians that were not going to check and stop the progress of the railroads, which he wrote in a letter to Grant. But he wrote a letter also to his wife that goes back to the Civil War.
Yeah.
He was just getting warmed up on the genocide business.
Yes, he wrote a letter to his wife early in the Civil War where he essentially said that this war will not be won if we merely wage it against the soldiers alone. It must be waged against the civilians themselves of the South. And his charming wife wrote back agreeing with him, saying that the people of the South must be driven into the sea like swine. And these were fellow citizens they were talking about, that they were talking about. Murdering and pushing in the ocean like hogs, and so Sherman was a genocidal maniac.
Mm-hmm. And you make a very interesting point about how the Plains Indians were actually in sympathy with the Southern cause during.
Oh, yes, the Plains Indians hated the U.S. government, you know, because of how many times it had murdered them and broken its promises, broken its treaties, and it was in sympathy with the Confederate cause because it just saw what the government was doing to the Confederates as what it had been doing to them for many years.
Yeah, it appears that Sherman was also quite on his high horse about what he considered inferior human beings, which included Negroes, slaves, Indians, or even whites that disagreed with him.
Right. If you get into the literature of Sherman and his memoirs and what he said during this era, you know, you'll find that he used spooky language. He said that what he was doing to the Indians was, in his words, the final solution to the Indian problem. And he said that he had a quest for racial purity or racial cleansing of the land, and he called Negroes mongrels, who intermarried with whites, and he was terrified of the fact that what would happen in the rest of the country is what happened in New Mexico, where there was intermarriage between blacks and whites and Indians, and who he called the mongrels, and so this was a very creepy racial cleansing operation when you talk about the war in the Plains Indians.
They actually, I think you made the point that, was it Dodge that suggested that they actually turned the Indians into slaves?
Right.
To kill the
right. Grenville Dodge, as soon as the Civil War was over, Grenville Dodge, the chief engineer of the Transcontinental Railroad, recommended that we make slaves of the Indians and make them do the digging of the beds, you know, the hard back-breaking work, and they would be watched over by U.S. Army soldiers so that the soldiers who had just were veterans of the Civil War would have immediately been turned into overseers on these slave plantations, essentially, that would have been not growing cotton, but building railroad beds. But the U.S. Army decided to kill all the Indians instead of enslaving them.
But, you know, even though there was this overt genocide going on, these basically genocidal maniacs were a little bit sensitive to being caught by the media.
Yes.
And Sherman made some promise to Sheridan.
Yes, Sherman, I think there was one incident where some journalists showed up out west while this was going on, and it must have caused a panic among the military generals. And so Sherman himself, since he was such a big shot in Washington and a personal friend of President Grant, told his subordinates, like Sheridan, that don't worry about it. I will cover for you. I will go to Washington if necessary and dispel any kind of talk of atrocities going on. And, of course, Sherman was a very intimidating figure, and any politician would really be taking a huge risk to his career by countering or criticizing General Sherman in the few years after the Civil War was over.
So you may mention that there were about 45,000 Indians murdered in that 25-year period. How many different attacks did they...
Well, according to the history books, there were over 1,000 attacks on Indian villages, and they would typically happen in the winter months when all the families would be together, whereas in the summer the men were out hunting and so forth, and fishing, and gathering food. And so they would sneak up on Indian villages. And by this time, of course, they had Gatling guns and repeating rifles. And the Indians sometimes had rifles, but mostly bows and arrows. And the Indians learned to shoot very fast with repeating arrows. But, of course, they could never keep up with cannon.
Right.
Or Gatling guns and
right.
repeating rifles.
Right. That's actually been a theme in history. Those with the superior weaponry typically
of course.
Dominate. Yes. Yes. And but they went so far as to, you know, wipe everything out. You know, the dogs.
Yes. They when they attacked the Indian village, they would kill everything: women, children, dogs, cattle. There was also a government war of extermination against the buffalo.
Yeah.
The buffalo did not disappear, almost disappeared, just because of what we call the tragedy of the commons. You know, in the open plains, you could sell a buffalo hide for about $3. And so people went out and just shot hundreds of them a day, as many as you could shoot, and skin the hides and sell them for $3 a piece. But on top of that, it was official government policy to encourage people to go out there to do this, because they understood that the Indians relied on the buffalo for food, clothing. They even used the sinews, the dried sinews of the buffalo, to make fish hooks with. And so if you got rid of the buffalo, that would help starve out the Indians, was the government's thinking.
I'm going to steal a little bit of your thunder from your lecture, but you brought up this quote from General Sheridan that regarding this extermination of the buffalo, he said, "Let them kill, skin, and sell until the buffalo is exterminated, as it is the only way to bring lasting peace and allow civilization to advance."
That's right. If everyone is dead, I guess it would be a very peaceful place on the Great Plains.
So, talk a little bit about Custer. You said there were some rather interesting anomalies about how he tried to make the killing a little more palatable.
One of the really creepy things about George Armstrong's Custer is that he carried a band with him on all of his exploits, and the band would play an Irish jig called Gary Owens during the killing and the massacring of men, women, and children in these Indian villages. And the historian S.L.A. Marshall, who I've mentioned before, said that apparently Custer thought that the music would make the killing seem more methodical or less less bothering to him, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. A whole different paradigm as to how... it's hard to wrap our heads around the way these people were thinking.
It's a totalitarian mindset, and it's led by a man, Sherman, who was a genocidal maniac, and he had General Grant's blessing, who was then President Grant by the time you get into the Grant administrations. And so these are not the heroes that we think they were.
All right, folks, we're going to take another brief break. Please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market. We'll be back right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Thomas DiLorenzo. We've been talking about stateless but not lawless, the myths of the American West. And the last segment, we covered some rather disturbing information about how the U.S. actually engaged in very planned genocide against the American Indians. And... Tom, I have to say, it's difficult to listen to this, but I think it's very important for us to actually get this information on the record and out among as many listeners as possible. But tell us about this Kiowa village attack in 1874.
Well, I use that in one of my publications as yet another example of what was going on during the so-called Indian Wars, where a Kiowa village was attacked and... they killed something like 1,000 horses that were there, and they captured several hundred of the Kiowas and put them in a dungeon in a military fort, and literally every once in a while, every day, threw some chunks of raw meat in, like they had wild animals living in there, and that's how they treated them, which was, I guess, better than they treated some of the other Indians, by just killing them outright.
Did some of the Indians actually try to escape?
Sure, they often try to escape, and who wouldn't?
Yeah, of course.
That sort of situation. The famous Crazy Horse, when he was captured, and after he was captured, he was murdered as a captive. And you may have heard of the famous book "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee." The reason it has that title, and it was made into a movie also, is that after he was murdered, his parents were able to have his body. And so they cut out his heart and buried it where they thought no one would ever find it, on the Wounded Knee River. But it turns out there was another big Indian massacre right there at Wounded Knee where his heart was buried. And that's why that book had that title.
This culture of violence in our culture extended into our foreign policy over the next several decades as well.
It's one of the craziest things about American history, or the history of the government, is that the government claimed after the Civil War to be especially virtuous. You may have heard of the phrase American exceptionalism. So these same people that were perpetrating these acts of mass murder and genocide against the Plains Indians, claimed to be the most virtuous people on earth, and they made the argument, and they still to this day, that by definition, just about anything they do is virtuous because they are so virtuous themselves. Teddy Roosevelt, when we were at war with the Filipinos, because we helped the Filipinos get rid of the Spanish Empire, but then the U.S. government wanted to make them part of the American Empire, and the Filipinos did not want to be a part of anyone's empire. They wanted independence. And so there was a war in which American military killed some 200,000 Filipinos, and Teddy Roosevelt justified it, using big quotation marks around the word justified, by calling the Filipinos savages and wild beasts and dehumanizing them. And we have done that after that. During World War I, there was a huge demonization campaign against German Americans and everything German to justify American entry into World War I, which, of course, was disastrous. And so it's sort of the same template, the same strategy that went well into the 20th century that began in the Civil War years.
So we're going to close the show, folks, with a quick quote from Ludwig von Mises. He said, "What distinguishes man from animals is the insight into the advantages that can be derived from cooperation under the division of labor. Man curbs his innate instinct of aggression in order to cooperate with other human beings. The more he wants to improve his material well-being, the more he must expand the system of the division of labor. Concomitantly, he must more and more restrict the sphere in which he resorts to military action." So, Tom, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Michael.
So, folks, this is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. Visit us on the web. You can download this and all of our shows for free. Check us out on iTunes. And please, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.